This is the Creative Sports Podcast. My name is Justin Peterson.
And joining me are Brock Rahm.
I was literally going to say nothing of actual consequence. It's creating an edit point here.
And Garrett Wright.
All right.
Today we're joined by Michael Long, manager of video production with Inter-Miami CF. He posed a question in the Slack channel wanting to talk workflow processes and techniques as they work to streamline some inefficiencies for next season. As a team coming off their inaugural season, this seemed like a great conversation to have and share on this show.
Let's do 42. That sounded way off, but...
Part of the course for some of the other ones. The last couple of times it sounded pretty far off too, so...
All right.
All good.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the show. My name is Garrett Wright. I want to start out with a big thank you to APM Music for donating the tracks we use on this podcast. Also, a reminder that this podcast is an extension of the sports creative community on Slack. So if you're hearing this and not a member of that community yet, you should head over to sportscreativeslack.com and sign up for free.
All right, so today we have Michael Long joining us from Miami of the MLS. So excited to have a conversation with him based on a question that he posed in the Slack channel, which is around processes and techniques of groups and workflows. And that's definitely going to be the meat of this conversation. But Michael, I think the interesting part of your path is that you were in sports and then got out of sports, worked for CNN. And then you got back into sports this year with Miami. So that coupled with the fact that this is also an inaugural season for the team dealing with the pandemic and everything. And I think it'll be interesting to get your take on how your team is set up and the numbers on your team and also the workflows that you have in place as a first year team and you know the foundation that you're looking to build off of. So really appreciate you joining us here.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, guys.
So let's get into your background a little bit. Looks like you graduated in 2012. Can you just talk us through, getting your start in the industry and how your career has unfolded?
Well, yeah. Thanks for having me, guys. Started in 2012 after I graduated from Florida Atlantic. I was fortunate to get an opportunity with ESPN, working in the digital production department. And that was back when sort of digital video was just starting to take off and everybody was just starting to put together teams. So I was part of sort of an ad hoc team and we sort of we broke records and, you know, had some great, great, great years at ESPN, learned from some great people. And I transitioned from there and went into more live event production and feature production with Longhorn Network. So it's a little more out in the field, kind of wanted to get out of the office, get out in the field and get my hands dirty in terms of like shooting and recording and you know field audio and stuff like that. And went from there to CBS where I was working features, mostly feature production. Did a little bit of studio producing as well, live shows, live shows, specials, all that kind of stuff. And then I went to CNN, kind of wanted to get out of the sports industry and do some work outside of sports. And so I got the opportunity to work for CNN. I was in a program where we kind of rotated to different departments within the CNN sound and image department. And I was able to work with, you know, digital and I was able to work with the newsroom and I was able to work with sports. So I was able to kind of transition within that role and learn a lot of different things. And then now I'm with Inter-Miami managing the production side. So back working with the team for the first time since college, I kind of had a similar role at FAU where I was, you know, managing the media and video for all sports. So excited to be back.
Yeah, you touched on quite a few different opportunities that you had. It sounds like you have live experience, some digital experience, and what direction were you pulled then? I mean, feature producing or, you know, doing production with that. And I guess, what do you consider is your preference there of the types of content that you really enjoy working on?
Well, I think I approached it as if I didn't choose to go to grad school. So I kind of approached the early years of my career as, you know, trying to learn how the wheel turns and trying to learn how everything feeds into the next department. So like, how does digital help broadcast, feed to digital, feed to all the different aspects of any media entity that's going to, you know, output content. So everything is sort of interconnected. So learning that was kind of my number one goal. And then everybody kept telling me, you gotta be able to do everything, So I think that being able to look at whatever job that I have through that lens of having experience in all those different places, I think that's what sort of makes me valuable. And that's what I like the most, is being able to kind of jump in different situations and have some knowledge and be able to operate.
All right. So let's jump into your current job with Miami now, and get a better understanding of what you do there on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. So I came in during training camp last season as the team was being put together, sort of as the front office team was also being put together. So it was an interesting time. So all the infrastructure that you would be used to seeing at some of the other places that I've been at, ESPN, CBS, we got an opportunity to build that. And that was something that attracted me to the position, because I knew that I would get an opportunity to have a hand in that. So all of our workflow processes, a lot of the equipment that we've purchased and software that we purchased to help us be more efficient, I've got the opportunity to kind of lay those bricks and be a part of building that up. So that's been interesting. It's been a challenge at times, of course, because we're just building from scratch, but just kind of taking my knowledge that I had from all those places, and then also talking to different people in the industry like you guys, we've been able to build a pretty solid process. Right now, you know, we have video production, which is myself. I manage the video production team. We have two interns, and then we have two videographers / sort of content coordinators. And then on the content side, we have, you know, photographers, senior manager of content. We also work with digital, we work with communication. So it's a lot of moving parts that go into getting all this content out and sort of matching what comes out on the editorial and digital side with what we put out on the video side.
It kind of wraps us around to your question very well, which goes into process. And you talked about building those processes kind of from the ground up. Where did you start with that? I think we said before we started recording here that, you know, everybody can do it differently, and everybody can be right and everybody can be wrong at the exact same time. Right. So how did you approach it when you were saying, okay, we're going to do this way, and what resources did you use to get there?
So I took from my broadcast experiences as well as my feature producing experiences, and sort of like building that foundation. It's really about organization, and it's about streamlining inefficiencies, and it's about getting everybody on the same page. So what I like to do is I like to disseminate information from a whole bunch of different platforms, just so that there's no question of what it is that we need to do, how we need to do it, who's doing what, and where it's going. So what I've started is we work with a program called Mondays. I'm not sure if you guys are familiar. So we work with that program to sort of assign different projects to our videographers, who's shooting, who's editing, et cetera, et cetera. There's also I lean very heavily on Google, sort of the Google version of Excel. So I've built, you know, a content calendar that tells, you know, what editorial is coming out with, what digital is coming out with. So I can look at that on a week by week basis and say, here's what we need to produce for video to, you know, link to that. And we also have a production schedule that goes week by week that tells, you know, who's the shooter, what's the event, what's the time, what's the location, how many hours you're going to spend at that particular production. And then on the edit side, how many hours you're going to spend there. It gives you sort of soft details in the production calendar, like, are you going to add fonts? Are you going to add, you know, transitions? Is this going to be something that's going to be raw that we're just going to deliver to the comms team? So like all that information is there. And we communicate through Slack, which, you know, has become sort of like the industry standard. So file sharing, all these different platforms are compatible, sort of have, you know, plugins with Slack. So we try to make it where all these things are interconnected. In the beginning of each week, I send out sort of like an overview of what we have to do for the week, and then we're looking ahead to what we need to pre-produce for the next coming weeks and months.
I think I have a few friends who are software engineer developers, and one thing pretty much all of them have, which I'm seeing a little bit more in the production industry, is a project manager, right? And we had one at Notre Dame, and it was very helpful. but it almost seems like you're kind of doing a hybrid role where you're still doing your production work, but you're also doing production or project management. Do you think that's a fair assessment, as you're really kind of leaning more into like a project management hybrid type role?
Yeah, that was another thing that was interesting and attractive to me when, you know, my supervisor came to me and sort of described what the role would be. I think I've come to the point, I think we all, as we mature in our careers, we come to the point where we've reached a certain level of mastery at our craft. And of course, like, we're always trying to get better, we're always trying to learn, we're always trying to improve, but you reach a certain level of mastery. And when you take that next step is when you're able to balance your own workload and then also sort of give directives and coordinate and work with sort of like the higher ups on, you know, what the overall vision is. And then you also sort of break that down, chew it up, and disseminate it to the people that are working underneath you. So that hybrid role has definitely helped me to grow in the last year.
I think it's interesting because no matter what people think of processes, I don't think anybody in the industry would say, oh, well, we're just too organized. That's our biggest issue, is we're too organized, right? Like, everybody can still be more organized, you know, and be better about it.
As creatives, we like organized chaos anyway, so.
Mm-hmm.
So you talked a little bit about project management there, and you also mentioned comms, broadcast, digital. Can you explain a little bit more about the structure internally about how you interface with them? I mean, is your group also posting content on social, or you're prepping the content to give it to somebody else to post on social to you're sharing with broadcast? Like, how does that interaction work?
So we coordinate at the beginning of the week, and everybody sort of lets us know from the video production standpoint what it is that they're going to need from us. So whether that's B-roll for broadcast, whether that's an interview feature that's going to be on sort of the broadcast for that live game that week. If it's social, it's, you know, hey, we're going to need these social videos. We have these features on editorial that are scheduled for these days. We want to use something from you guys, whether it be like a 15-second clip, 20-second clip, to drive people from our social platforms to our website to read that editorial or that feature or that sponsored content. We have some sponsored stuff with Dunkin' Donuts that comes out on Tuesday, like a Tuesday trivia. So we try to, you know, we try to meet with them early in the week and brainstorm ways that we can support. So I think that we've done a really good job of setting up that information flow, and sort of we're all comfortable sort of crossing the wires, and that we all reach out to each other. And so I think we've done a good job of establishing that communication.
And kind of along the same lines that Brock alluded to with your role, that's a hybrid role, because you're a small team, do your videographers also edit? What other types of work is on their plate in addition to being videographers?
We've been very fortunate in the fact that, you know, both of our videographers and our interns have the ability to shoot and edit. And to a certain degree, I want them to sort of be, I want you guys to be producers on the field, so that if you see something that you can capture and we can package that and sell it to social, or we can package that and sell it to .com, we package that and sell it to the app. We have some content that we put exclusively in our Inter Miami app. So just sort of, you know, encourage them to be producers on the field, and encourage them to be extremely, extremely well-rounded, whether that's, you know, script writing, whether that's, you know, building a front end, whether that's shooting or editing. So we, like you said, we're a small operation. We try to sort of be agile and mobile in that way.
I think after project management, one of the other good places to potentially go here is asset management. And I think this one might be more unique just because of the fact that with COVID, I guess Florida's maybe in a state that is in the office a little bit more than some of the rest of the country, just based on how things have gone. But can you just talk through how you usually collect the content, and is there a central place to store that on a network access for everybody, or how do you go about that?
So that was one of the challenging things sort of at the beginning of quarantine, but I'm glad that we went through it in our first year. Now, this year we have a much better understanding of sort of how to share files and work remotely and work collectively on one project. We use DAM is the platform that we use to store all of our assets, whether it be photo, video, and we have a system where we have a log channel in Slack to where we'll, you know, if the videographer shoots an interview, He's going to log that interview. He's going to put that log into the Slack channel so that I coming in as if I'm produce something and say like, hey, we need to incorporate these three interviews to make a feature. I know that this interview is located on DAM. It's named this. It's broken up into this many files. This is the file size, the length. So we try to be coordinated in that way. We also work with Dropbox. So Dropbox and DAM are our main two. We're still working on getting an actual server and sort of a network to work off of. So that's been probably our biggest challenge is not having a server. So what I've had to do is create a system that mimics a server in a certain way. So all of our drives are mirroring each other, and we try to, you know, go through at the end of every month or every 2 weeks and sort of, you know, make sure that our drives are matching up and we have corresponding folders and things like that. So when one of us is editing a project, we can easily hand it off to the next person.
It's interesting with new franchises, right? You don't have a blueprint to work with on how to store, log your footage. You're kind of, you know, creating that as you go. Are you doing something to document those standards? So moving forward, people, you know, maybe after you're gone or after a couple people are gone, have an idea of how you did it?
Yes, absolutely. As we're bringing on like new interns this year, that's something that I wanted to focus on in the off season. As we're sort of leading up to preseason, that's something I'm working on as well. Sort of putting together a comprehensive step-by-step, this is how we do things, essentially. Like sort of a standard operating procedure guide, if you will. So that's definitely one of our priorities going into 2021, something that we're working on.
I think that's the advantage new franchises have now versus the past. I remember getting into the industry. I'm not going to say when, because it's been a while. But it was kind of the Wild West, right? It was really the Wild West. It was kind of, you know, there were tapes on shelves and logs in them, which was extremely helpful. And that was a standard forever. But when it went to digital, it was very much so the Wild West. And a lot of footage got lost at a couple different places I worked, important franchise type footage. You had to go back and find somebody else at a news station who had it, or a league office that might have had it. Whereas now you kind of get a little bit of a leg up, because you've been able to see the trials and errors that others have done and might give you a step up to preserve some of that early franchise footage.
That was something I just want to jump in here. I know if you're about to talk, but that was one of the things that sort of going after this past season, it was like it being our inaugural season, like what do we keep? What do we get rid of? Because I'm thinking in my head, like people are going to want this footage to create stuff maybe 20 years down the line. So, we combed through everything with sort of a fine tooth comb and a magnifying glass and kept all the things that we felt could be repurposed and repackaged later on down the line. So.
Yeah, that's the biggest challenge, right? Because I always like to call myself a hoarder in that sense. I mean, I've never gone through an inaugural season with a team. But I mean, that footage is going to be used for everything for the longevity of the team. So, it's interesting, but you know, I think it seems like you're getting to the point where a network server is going to be your next step, and then systematizing everything. And I talk to my group all the time about logging something for somebody 20 years down the line, right? Because that puts you in a frame of mind where you're not using, if you're in Pittsburgh, you're not putting Big Ben on everything. You're putting Roethlisberger, because people that come in 20 or 30 years down the line may not know that what his nickname was, but they're going to search for his last name. So how can you boil all of that down into something that's digestible for something for somebody much further down the line and create a system that will allow people to find what they're looking for when they go in to look for it? So that's interesting, but it is a challenge to, you know, with using Dropbox, using DAM and different ways, and having not having that centralized hub of where all that content lives. And that's kind of one of the reasons why I was asking you earlier about working with your broadcast group, working with your digital social group, and how all of you interface. If they're creating content too, is there, you know, putting it all in the same place to make sure everybody has access to it is something that actually we're going through right now, trying to make sure that we have a centralized place, and it's not every group doing their own thing, just because that makes it much more difficult. You're not leveraging all the assets that are being captured and created, right? So you're not able to leverage that and have the best ROI on your initial shoot or your edit. You're kind of fracturing your background and all of that. So that's interesting. And you know, so I know Brock and I have talked on here before about having a asset management system that sits over the top of the network storage, that which is how we go about it. And that's, for us, has been helpful because we can also add ratings to plays, especially for gameplay. So if you know, you can search across your whole database and be able to say, okay, well, I'm looking for the best plays of the season from XYZ player. Now I can search the last name of the player. I can search, you know, a top rating, and I'm going to get some of the best clips that that the team has logged as you go. And it's not sexy. It's not something that that everyone jumps up and raises their hand about. But it is necessary to continue to provide content and you know, value over the length of all that content as you go along. So be interesting to hear as you advance through the off season of what you end up doing and what you're able to do working with the IT department.
And going back on what you said, like ROI. So I come from a space where they were at ESPN, they were always pushing sort of like repurposing, repackaging, because you know, your number one asset is the content that whatever takes place on the field. So however many ways that we can repackage and repurpose that, and you know, cut a super cut with all the different social angles, all the different broadcast angles, all the field level footage, all the different ways that we can, like you said, like leverage that one moment. That bowls, you know, better for us in the end when we're looking at sort of those metrics that we're judged on at the end of the year. So
at Notre Dame, one of the biggest efforts we always had to do was try and get raw clips to the social team, which are RSID's PR team, as quickly as possible, and as efficiently as possible. There's a lot of process driven behind that. You know, we were using some automated Dropbox type folders, things like that. Are you seeing a same demand with your team of getting content quickly to the social team? And if so, how are you facilitating that?
So yeah, that's one of the things we've tried to streamline throughout the year, from the beginning of the year until now. So now we're at the point where we're trying to work directly with social. We have access to these channels, and we can go ahead and post the highest quality video. We're getting trained on CMS and all these different systems so that we don't have to go through that sort of that middle ground. So we'll export something in a low res, we'll upload it to Slack, it gets approved, and then we have the bigger file, and then we can just push it straight there. So sometimes in game, we'll, you know, have card readers out there. We'll put our card in at halftime, make a 15-second sort of montage mashup of our best clips, and then we'll push that straight to social. But that's been one of the biggest things for us, is how do we streamline that time from when a moment happens to when we get it up? Because you lose so much in such a short span of time in terms of like that momentum and that leverage that you were talking about.
Yeah, that's great. I think, you know, building that trust between departments is so important, right? And allowing you to understand that you understand the voice of the channels, you know, and how you're going to craft that, and that you're not going to go rogue, I think is really important. Because, you know, I see it a lot. You know, teams are obviously trying to get things out quick, but somebody will send somebody in social a, you know, cinema camera angle that doesn't have a LUT on it. It's just flat, and it'll go out on social. And I know, you know, the average viewer probably isn't thinking much of it. They're probably thinking it's an artistic or stylistic choice, but I see that as a content creator, and I'm like, somebody is just too quick there, or they didn't have a process in line for that. So that's great to hear that there's trust there, that you guys know what you're doing, and you can be trained in a way that's beneficial to the team.
So let's talk about the shooting aspect of this, because you were just starting to get into it a little bit there. And obviously going from the asset management side, that's the back end of what you're capturing here. So can you give us a little, I've never shot a soccer game. Can you give us a background on where you're where's your team positioned during a game, and how many different people do you have shooting the game?
So, man, this year was, again, a big challenge with COVID and all the different protocols. It really depended on what stadium we were at and what that specific stadium, what their protocol was. We only sent multiple shooters on two road games, and that was before sort of the season was delayed for COVID. But at home, we have three videographers. Two are on the sidelines, and then one is in, which book, I guess, will be the end zone. And so that's how we position ourselves. But if COVID protocol wasn't in place, we'd be on the corners. So it'd be one person on 1, 2, 3 corners, and then you can kind of roam up and down half of your sideline to get the best shot, depending on what the situation is. And then that person kind of roam back and forth across the end line.
So they could basically trail like a sideline ref.
Yeah, that exact concept. And it's really all the stadiums, from my experience, soccer stadiums are so unique, much more so than, you know, like a basketball arena, like in terms of like media, like where you can place yourself. Cause some places you're stuck. So like we went to LA and you're kind of stuck in one spot at LAFC stadium. In our stadium, there's a gap where you can sort of roam up and down, and there's place for you to kind of be fluent. But it really depends on where you are. DC, we're kind of stuck in one spot. It just really depends on how close the fans are to the field, how much, you know, operating space they've given media and what restrictions they have in place.
Yeah, it's interesting. Everything, every stadium, every arena, regardless of what sport you're shooting, is different for everybody. What are the? Do they each have a different job that they're charged with doing? Do you have somebody that is capturing more ISO content, you know, focusing on the ball, or is it, or do you kind of just let them all flow, like shoot how they how they're flowing with the game?
So the general rule is if you're shooting on the defensive end, you're going to try to get some of those feature style shots, like the really tight ISOs, the really tight shots of the ball. If you're on the offensive end, you're going to try to have a medium shot and sort of capture everything that's happening. You want to get the buildup and you want to get the goal, obviously. So if you're shooting on the backside, then you're working on getting some of those ISOs and some of that stuff. If you're shooting on the offensive end, you want to be a little bit more conservative because we don't want to miss, like, of course, we don't want to miss any goals. So it's a little bit different from any of the other sports because it's like you have that one opportunity. There might be one goal in the game, and that's one opportunity to catch that goal. So you kind of can. There's not as many risks that you can take.
I know Brock's mentioned before having fail safes, right? Like when you're shooting an NFL game, you have broadcast cameras, you have in venue cameras. What are you guys largely that team that's capturing the whole game? Are there additional cameras or anything that are also capturing that you get that footage? I know this is all maybe different this year than it might be going forward because of COVID and different circumstances, but I'm just curious about how you fit into the in-venue experience in addition to the capturing experience.
We are able to pull from, you know, our in-venue broadcast team. They do a good job of getting that stuff to us quickly. We do an all-access style feature that we try to get out less than 48 hours after the conclusion of the game. So, you know, they do a great job of getting that stuff to us as quickly. And anything that we miss is most definitely in the melt, or if we go through the entire game feed itself, we'll be able to find that. But they do a good job of getting those melts to us. And we have, you know, immediate access. We have our own in-house team for that.
Nice. Yeah. So from my perspective, I always tell my group, shoot tight, you know, get the reactions and the you know, the facial reactions. If you're tight and they kick the ball and you're not going to be able to like zoom out and go follow the ball, obviously you know, shooting basketball is a little bit different because the field is not so wide. You know, it's a much smaller playing field, and obviously there's a smaller goal than there is in soccer with the basketball hoop. Just being able to get some of those ISO shots, the rack focuses and different kinds of things can help drive it. But it's interesting to hear the different different takes just because obviously there's a lot more scoring in basketball too, right? There's a lot more action happening up in your side of the field. I mean, half a game could be played on the defensive side in soccer. So it's just interesting to hear how different games and different people approach how they do all this stuff. All right, let's jump into editing a little bit, and if you can talk a little bit about what you're using and how you're using it right now for processes.
We're using the Premiere Pro. So we're using Premiere Pro. My whole career, it's been Premiere Pro. Final Cut worked on briefly, and then ESPN has their own editing software called QCut. But Adobe Premiere Pro, we sort of have a system of how we organize our, every project is sort of organized the same way. And when a match is shot, the footage is then logged. So you're talking about, you know, being able to punch in the server, whoever's name and the best place for that person come up. So we've come up with a system where we'll log plays from a match, and we use a star system just to make it easy for us to find the best plays from that particular player. So if we search, you know, LGP, which is one of our better players, you'll see the 4-star plays from him, the 3-star, the 2-star, and the 1-star. So you'll sort of, we need to cut some B-roll for someone, if we need to make a montage or anything like that, or we make a lot of trailers and hype videos, things like that, we can just go through and sort of pick out those five star clips and put them into a project.
Yeah, I think that's so important. People think about the metadata related, but also ranking shots is so insanely important, because just like you said, when I was working on the college athletic side, that was so important, because at the end of the year for seniors, we had to do, you know, banquet videos, highlight reels, things like that. It makes your job so much easier on the back. And if you can just say, okay, here's this player's top 5-star plays from the season, boom, 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 right? It's not saying that you just sit there and bang out that feature and you don't care about the quality. It gives you such a good jumping point that you can focus on the quality of the feature without worrying about, okay, where's this footage at? Where did I go with this? Was this a good play? This says goal. Is it a good goal? Who knows? You know, like that's it's good to hear that you guys are doing a ranking system, because I think that's so important.
One of our mantras for this year is sort of make the easier things easier and make the harder things harder. So just exactly what you said, sort of building your process out so that the easy requests you can knock out incredibly quickly and without any sort of issues or problems, and sort of the stuff that we really, the meaty stuff or the long features, the stuff that's really going to pop, we can put more time and energy into that stuff. So processes is huge, huge, huge.
You know, all this stuff is interconnected. And once you, you know, it's great that you all have drives that are kind of synced up so that you can help each other find things or make sure that you all have the same layout as you're going through with the folder structure and everything, because the post-production side is all really tied in with the how you capture and store your content too, right? And so is there anything editing related that, you know, as far as keyboard shortcuts that you guys are, you know, you're really into for efficiencies and making sure that you can fly as fast as you think or anything along those lines?
Especially with our interns, I'm big on shortcuts. I'm big on how you organize your timeline, how you organize your project, color coordination, using your shortcuts. Like my interns will tell you that, like, it just gives me anxiety if someone's just going, if you're not using the proper shortcut to save yourself 5 seconds, because over the course of, so if you're working on something for 10 hours, you're gonna spend so much time, you know, excess time if you're not using the shortcuts, if your project's not organized in a way where if you hand it off and I don't know exactly what's going on, like it's gonna stall the entire production. So I'm big on sort of color coordinating folders within Premiere Pro, making sure that, you know, A roll, B roll, different audio is on the right channels, effects are on the right channels, everything's color coordinated, everything's named and categorized. So yeah, we're definitely big on that.
Well, I think we can get in and break down some of those, like the folder structure. You talk about audio being on the right channel. How do you guys go about that and laying it all out? Because it sounds like you have a little bit of a system there where you expect, so everyone, if anyone has to jump into somebody else's project, they have a general understanding of what it is.
Yeah. For example, let me pull up one of our projects here. You have a project folder inside that project. You're going to have whatever it is that you're working on. For here we have a AJ De La Garza, which is one of our defenders. He has an interview. So there's an overall interview folder in any working project that you have here. So you're going to go to, you're going to have an asset folder, of course. You're going to have your music. You're going to have animations. You're going to have graphics. You're going to have your LUTs or anything that you're pulling from sort of a third party or plugins or anything like that. All that's going to be organized in your asset folder. And then you also have a PR folder and you have an in and out. So if you're anything that you're exporting out of that particular project is going to go on out on out folder, and the actual project itself goes in the in folder. And then you have within your assets, you're going to have, you know, AJ's highlights, and you're going to have his highlights all ranked 4-star. It's going to be AJ. It's going to be, you know, Inter Miami IMCF versus Houston _ AJ _ tackle. And it's going to be 2 or 3 stars there. So all those clips are going to be there. You're going to have your interview. It's going to be another folder. You're going to have your A camera, your B camera. You're going to have your Zoom audio. It's going to, so we kind of break it down like that. So once you do all that, you then you bring it into your project itself. You're working off of one big asset. So working off one big asset folder, you drop that down. You have everything else that you need. You color coordinate that. And then let's say, for example, we're talking about this particular project. You're going to lay down your A roll, which is the A camera, the interview that has the audio sync. That's going to be on your V1 and your A1, A2. And then you're going to put your on V2, you're going to put your B camera, of course. You're going to change the color of that, right? So your A camera is going to have, let's say, for example, you make it orange. It's your A camera and your audio one, audio two, all that's going to be orange. Your B camera is going to be on V2, that's going to be purple, right? And then you're going to have on V3, let's say, for example, you're taking broadcast footage that has audio synced. So on V3 and A3 and 4, that'll be yellow. So you'll have your broadcast audio on A3, A4, and it'll all be yellow. Your broadcast B-roll will be on, you know, V3. And then for V4, you'll have your field level slow-mo that doesn't have any audio sync. That'll be purple. That'll be on V4. And so on and so forth. You'll have your namer, which will be on sort of, it'll be on V7. You'll have your adjustment layer with your color correction will be on V8, and so on and so forth and so on and so forth. So like everything's sort of like broken down and categorized to where I could jump into anyone's folder and I can know, okay, like everything is separated this way. When I go to these folders, I know everything's going to be here, and I can sort of like move forward with it. Cause it's sort of the save time. We hand off projects a lot.
Yeah. That's all great. And good background for people listening to be able to understand the layout and how different people approach different their projects and go about that. And it sounds similar. Anytime we have a mic, it's usually on A1 for interviews, for if we mic a player up or anything like that, try and keep it systematic that way. I'm actually surprised that Brock didn't jump on me for not asking or getting into the equipment a little bit more with you when we were talking about shooting. We didn't really touch on equipment, so I feel like now we should backtrack and go touch on that so we can let Brock nerd out a little bit on some of this.
That's your thing. That's your lane is video equipment, or is that your?
It's my whole job. My whole job, man. Okay. I try not to be overbearing about it. So.
What do you guys shoot on?
So Justin, that's probably really more of a question for you. I'm technically on the integration side now. So I don't shoot, although I do have a Blackmagic Pocket Cinema Camera 6K. That is my personal camera that I use. But JP, I'll let you take that.
Sure. Yeah. So when we started, we have an ENG camera that we used, which was our initial camera that we used to shoot on the baseline with. And it was great to take to community events and different shoots that we went on, just because of the flexibility with the 2/3 sensor and the servo lens that we were able to put on that. It was easy and flexible. We could get something far away, we could get something close up. Over the last handful of years, we've started to push more into Canon Centerline of cameras. So we have C100, a couple C200s, a C300 Mark II, and we've started to do a lot more feature content, which is why we push that way. So we also have some prime lenses that go with those. And we also have, you know, the standard photo lenses that we can attach to those. We have EF mounts and nothing PL. And that's kind of our fleet, I guess, for lack of a better term. And, we have a 5D Mark IV or Mark III, And we also have like DJI Osmo Pockets and a couple gimbals and those kinds of things. But that's our primary fleet.
Yeah, when I was at Notre Dame, we were very fortunate. We shot, we had three Aria Miras with PL glass, Fujinon Cabrio lenses, and then B4 adapters. And we had some Cineprimes in there too. And then we also had a couple Blackmagic Ursa Mini G2s. Well, one Ursa Mini regular and then an Ursa Mini G2, which I'm big fans of those cameras for the price. But yeah.
We are working with three Sony FS5s, and we have one C200 number of prime lenses for the Canon camera, and we have the 7200 with the two-time converter for the 7200s and a number of prime Sony lenses as well. And of course, like the DJIs, the GoPros, and things like that.
So I think what also is still a pertinent question, especially as it relates to process, is what resolution are you shooting in? What color space? What frame rate are you guys capturing? Because all that data obviously manages very differently.
So it sort of, I let my videographer sort of, like I said, be produced on the field. Whatever you feel is best for that particular situation. So let's say, for example, you know, you're able to catch some post-game reaction, and you want to catch that sound of sort of the players, you know, celebrating, high-fiving. Go 24, you know, shoot at 24 frames a second, and we'll shoot 24 frames a second. We'll have the audio. Also, we shoot games in 120 and 240. We have Zoom recorders with sort of a I forget what it's called. It's like a dish. It's like a small one of the smaller. It's like sort of a dish that you'll see on the side of a football game glass.
Oh, like a parabolic mic.
Parabolic. Yes, we have mini parabolics that record into our Zoom recorders as we're shooting 240 or 120. So majority of the actual in-game content is going to be, you know, either 240 or 120. A lot of the pre and post game will be in 24.
Interesting. That's a great idea to make sure you get that audio while you're shooting in slow-mo.
Oh, you asked about resolution. So this year we shot in 1920 by 1080, just because by the time we jumped into the season and got our team together, we were still kind of, you know, organizing all the gear that we had that was being shipped in. So we didn't sort of venture into the space of shooting raw or shooting 4K, which we're going to do this year. We shoot a lot of raw, a lot of 4K, and sort of maximize the cameras for what they can do. We've got some internal SSDs coming in, so we can shoot with our external recorders and things like that. So that's one thing. We're looking to take that jump this year in that perspective. What have you all colored on in the past? Do you have any experience with DaVinci or?
Yeah, it's so I always love the idea of shooting raw in log. I always shoot in log no matter what, but raw I'm always like, oh yeah, I want to shoot raw. But what I found in my personal experience is I have round tripped to DaVinci from Premiere to DaVinci and back twice in my life. In both of those times, well, really like three times, two of those were for full length documentaries I was working on, where that was my sole focus. And I basically spent months working on those documentaries. And the other time was for a large format commercial campaign for the Chiefs we were doing. And each time I liked it, but every single time I did it, I said, oh, this is totally not worth it for quick turnaround stuff. Now it's a little different because a lot more people are editing in DaVinci, which I think is super interesting. I think we're going to see more and more of that because it's free to get started with, right? So you're going to see a lot of people coming up through high school who just want something to edit with, and they're going to know DaVinci, and it's super powerful. But Lumetri's also gotten extremely powerful inside of Premiere. So what I've always done, and it's been pretty easy because Ari's color space has a very nice Rec 709 LUT that can go on things and get you like 90% of the way there. So for me, it's always been about finding a LUT that works, that's a base LUT, and Premiere automatically applies the Rec 709 LUT to the base of the clip when you bring it in, when you bring in a log Ari clip. So a lot of that work was done, but I like finding a base LUT and then pushing from there in Lumetri. And if you really want to round trip from DaVinci, or if you want to edit in DaVinci, right, I think that's there for bigger projects. I've always just found that taking something outside of your NLE and then bringing it back is always such a cumbersome process that it's generally hasn't been worth it for me. But I definitely see that changing moving forward.
Yeah, it depends on what you're trying to accomplish and how quick of the turnaround you want. We have typically shot game footage in our Rec 709. If we're shooting on our ENG camera, we typically shoot our Canon Centerline and YDR no matter what we're doing, just to help with the highlight and shadow roll off. But that's generally where we start and then pull out from there. And I haven't ever used DaVinci. I stick in Premiere, but there's definitely a lot that you can do within Premiere and bring things back using LUTs or understanding the scopes and bringing it back yep. that way.
Right there, scopes, you said it. I feel like if you understand the waveform monitors, the RGB parades, that type of stuff, you can kind of get a clip in whatever you're working with to look like you want, or you can match using that stuff. So what I actually do in Premiere when I use Lumetri, I have my editing timeline, and I always edit on an ultra wide, which basically gives me all my media bins, my timeline, my program preview. And then I have a Lumetri setup, which is like my Lumetri on the left side, my main program window, and on the right side, I have all my scopes just paraded. Right. So I think it's important as we talk about processes here, right? Editing is not just editing, right? I also have another one for audio mixing, right? That just completely transforms my layout to be my audio mix, right? So I think it's important. It's a lot easier to change a workspace layout, you know, than it is to, you know, for lack of a better word, half-ass something and not bring up a menu you need or not look at a meter you need for audio or an RGB parade, right? To get it right the first time, it's going to take you more time to correct that after your supervisor is like, this clip looks a little bluer than this other clip. Did you look at the RGB parade? You know, things like that. I always think it's good to build yourself out different layouts. So in your different processes, you can focus on the menus you actually need.
Yeah, and Adobe does a really good job of providing some basic layouts that you can use and customize however you see fit to make it work for you. Mine's kind of the same way. I have the scopes on the left hand side of my window. I have two screens set up, and one screen is 32 inches, the other is 24. And I keep a lot of my project panels and everything on the left screen, and then my right screen is my program, my source windows, my timeline. And then when I switch into the color space, it all become, you know, the top one is my program, bottom one is the source that I can use to highlight the white and make sure my RGB parade is big enough so that no matter what size the white that I'm trying to isolate is, that I can make sure I'm lining up the three different colors to make it white before I start doing anything else, color grading or anything like that, which I don't do a ton of, honestly. It is a lot more color correcting than it is color grading.
Do you grade on some of those more feature styles versus, I know like the highlights you're trying to get out quickly post game or even in game, you color correct, but do you go further integrating in some of that feature style content, or do you sort of like just kind of keep it simple, place a basic LUT on it or whatnot?
My general feeling is any sit down interview, I'm going to grade, because I'm usually going for a certain look, a certain something I want, to convey a certain emotion. And a lot of that plays into the lighting setup of the scene and things like that too. So I tend to, anything that's a feature for me, I tend to grade, especially if there's something narrative I'm trying to do with the look, right? Which that's so subjective, right? How is, you know, like you're doing a low hanging fruit example, you're doing a flashback or something, right? You might grade that differently. Whereas if I'm just doing a highlight over top of something for like a sit down talking head interview, I'll just color correct that, you know, and throw it in. But if I'm doing something that's a little bit more narrative, I'll definitely try to have some sort of grade and look for my interview for sure. And then my footage, depending on what I'm trying to convey there to the audience.
Yeah, I think you hit on something that's important for people to understand, is that you're setting the mood, you're playing psychologist and trying to help advance the story through your coloring, right? It's not the blue and teal that you're throwing on everything just because but it might, you know, we did, for playoff hypes is usually when I pushed it, when I was doing a lot more editing. I'd pull in my darks, I'd pull those a little bit more blue, to give it a feeling like there was a little bit more drama, a little bit more cinematic. A lot of times we also did our leaf color, which I think, is, you know, something that quite a few people have done. Obviously our green is, symbolic with our team, and, seeing all the green on the screen and, just has that play with our fans. So, but it should all come back to the story you're trying to tell and the impact you're trying to have emotionally.
Is there anything else? Is there anything that you guys do from a process standpoint, in terms of, you know, from the time you get your assets off of your card or from your CFAS or whatever, organizing your project and bringing it in, sort of like that whole process, or anything that you guys do differently, or any programs that you guys, we've started to incorporate Prelude into our yep. workflow, just to kind of make getting those assets, you know, duplicating them or copying them over, getting them where they need to be to make that whole process look easier. Do you guys, anything you guys want to talk about in terms of that?
Yeah, I know JP and I are similar here in that, I've always used CatDV wherever I went for asset management. It's one of the many out there. Prelude is a MAM too. CatDV is, you know, a separate program, probably a little bit more robust than Prelude. But for me, the biggest thing is just getting the assets into the asset management system, whether they're logged or not, right? Because for us, that meant you at least got it into a folder or into a structure for that season in that game, right? Even if it's not logged, it's in that season, it's in that game. And then we used CatDV to automate our LTO storage and our Amazon AWS backups. So if it wasn't in CatDV, it really wasn't getting backed up in a proper way. So for us, automating a lot of that, it would be you'd get done, you'd get your CFAS card out. We had a very specific folder structure, and that folder structure matched CatDV. And we had essentially a raw originals folder and a process folder. First thing CatDV would do is it would check the file to see if it's ProRes. If it's not ProRes, it was going to transcode it to ProRes immediately and then move it over to the process folder, which then initiates the backup. But if it was already ProRes, it would just immediately do that move. And then after so many days, I believe it was 120 days, after 120 days, our raw folder would eat its own tail and start deleting its own stuff because we weren't editing off that original, that raw space. For us at Notre Dame, both of those folders lived on the same drive. In an ideal world, I would want those two to be two different nearline storage arrays. So that way, if one failed, you have the other as a quick backup when you need it before you could pull stuff up from LTO or AWS if it was in the past 120 days. But again, that's just the process we went through. It wasn't really, for me, the most important things are getting things logged and getting metadata on them, right? And getting things backed up. Because if you do those two things, anything else is kind of gravy on top of that, right? Or you can't screw it up much past that. So for us, we just tried to do that in a streamlined and as efficient of a method as we possibly could.
Yeah, I think the important things that you touched on were creating the folder structure. Both of you touched on it. Just making sure that everybody has a consistent folder structure. We have, I like to say that we have an always on the road mentality because we are not connected to our server, even at home, because we don't own the arena. It's the Bruins arena and we rent it out. Even though we're at home, we still have external drives that we dump stuff to and then walk it back over to the office typically and dump it to our storage there. Even at our practice facility, it's the same thing. And then when we're on the road in a hotel and doing all that, it's kind of the same process. So the folder structure and the file structure that we initially create, it's the number of the game under or dash verse or at whatever three digit team name that the NBA sends out on the schedule. We follow the schedule. If Chicago is CHI, it's all caps. So you either do verse CHI or at CHI, and then it's underscore and then the date of the game. And then within that, we have different folders. If they're on the road, they can have a pregame folder, they can have a shoot around folder, they can have a quarter one, two, three, four folder, they can have a postgame folder. And it's pretty similar at home too. So it's just making sure that the structure of those folders is maintained so that when they get back and they dump all the footage to the server, we're working through trying to streamline that process so that they can send stuff back while they're still on the road and have it hit our servers, to going back to towards the beginning of the conversation, to make that footage accessible for everybody to use so that we can leverage it more and have it in our system. But it is that file and folder structure that is essential to make sure that that is the base of what you're doing. And then, as Brock alluded to, is the backing up, making sure that you have there's a 3-2-1 rule. It's three iterations in two different places. One of them is offsite. So we try and do that with LTO backup, and we're beginning to dip our toe into the cloud field, and that's largely proxies right now. So we're still working on through some of that, definitely. But it's a long process, though, right? You're not going to do everything today. I'm actually impressed with hearing how you guys are set up, the types of equipment that you have. That's usually something that you build up over time and isn't something you usually get fully up front. So that's great to hear that you guys are in a pretty good spot, and that you can spend maybe some more resources on building up some of the back end a little bit more, because you have the equipment and some of those kinds of things up front that really help drive the content creation part of it.
You mentioned proxies. How much do you guys use proxies? Is that a part of your general workflow, or is it more so for your bigger projects?
So for us, CatDV, and I say us, this is back my time at Notre Dame, proxies for us were generated by CatDV, and they're hugely beneficial because they're what populated the CatDV web client. And if a file was offline locally but was on LTO, you could see a preview of it before you restored it from LTO or AWS, right? What we ended up finally doing is our proxies were H.264 10 meg, now H.265 10 meg. We decided that that's all we were going to upload to AWS. And the reason being behind that is our monthly bill for AWS Glacier storage, even though it's cheap per gig, was getting extremely high, because at Notre Dame, we had 26 sports. They go year round, just terabytes and terabytes of footage, where locally that was eating its own tail, and LTO tape is cheap. In the cloud, it was just growing and growing and growing. And I remember we did the numbers, and it was something like we were going to spend $1 million in the next few years in storage on AWS, right? So we basically said, okay, what is the AWS storage for? The AWS storage is if our building gets hit by a tornado and we lose everything, fire, flood, hugely catastrophic event. And the likeliness of that happening is low, right? Especially in a modern facility. But if that did happen, would we really need the raw files back, or would we be happy that we just had high quality H.264, H.265 files? And we made the kind of economical decision to say we'd be happy just to have the footage in any usable format. So we started then using those proxies, and I use the word proxy very, very loosely because they were H.264 high bitrate still. We decided to just do that to AWS. So it was really twofold. We were never editing with proxies, mainly because we were never shooting 4K or 8K. We were shooting 1920 by 1080. And we were fiber channel back to the server. So there's no real reason for us to use proxy footage and then replace. So our proxy workflow was a little bit different.
Yeah, and for us to use proxies, we're going to the cloud with the proxies allows us to be more efficient and work from home, so that we can view the content before we go to download it, because we have a system set up to where we can go in to download the full res footage, but it's not as easily accessible. So we want to make sure that we're only downloading what we need, because then we also have to store it locally on an external drive here or wherever anyone is at home. And but it also, since it's in the cloud, it's also externally it allows us to have access to that footage outside the office. So then the other side of it is we've also upgraded our proxies to be 720p. So if we get in a situation where we have an emergency, or hey, we just need one clip and we need to be really quick, we can download the proxy, even if it's a 1920 by 1080 sequence, and toss it in without making it look too terrible. It's a quick short-term fix. Or if we're doing an edit and we know it's fully going to go on social, say there's a trade that happens, then I know I can create a 720p sequence and just download those 720p proxies and just edit in 720p, knowing that no one watching on their phone is going to know the difference. So those are the primary advantages that I've seen with going that route.
Talked a little bit about getting the files into Premiere or whatever editing software that we're using. I want to pick you guys as a brain a little bit about exporting, compression, how much you're going to compress you're compressing what you're giving to your social teams, et cetera, et cetera. Like what is standard sort of SOP for you guys? What are you exporting in? What are you delivering? What are you keeping? Yeah, what are you keeping for like long-term in terms of your final exports?
So our final exports, we'll keep H.264. We've talked a little bit about the asset management. I'm big on keeping the raw. And dumping that to LTO and making sure that we have that backed up. But we will keep the H.264 final version of a video. And it also kind of depends on your outputs, right? Like if I worked at an agency, I would probably do an MOV and make sure I kept that. We have so many different outputs in a given month that it just get to be a lot to export an H.264 and an MOV just to make sure you have that, because we're going to have the raw backup and the Premiere project's going to live on the server for a while. So we primarily do H.264 and we do one export because the video is going to go on YouTube. And then it's going to go on different social media platforms too. So that's kind of been an area that's been a little challenging for us, because how do you weigh doing four different exports to make sure each platform gets exactly what it's asking for versus time to move on to execute other creative or other other things that you have on your plate that you need to execute. So that's generally how we do it. Bitrate, I mean, when I first started in Chicago, and worked with the Bears, we were fighting bandwidth for people on, the end user. You don't really have as big of an issue nowadays because, people have, 4G cell phones that, they can stream content relatively easily. So I would generally say it's the lowest common denominator, but we generally just use the Vimeo preset. That's 16 to 20 variable bitrate. And that seems to work, because the other challenge too is, right, the bitrate, you can have a different bitrate for a presser than you can for game footage. Game footage is live action and movement. And the more you have of that, the higher the bitrate needs to be to keep it looking good. So I would typically suggest a two pass on that, but just keeping it simple and streamlined that way is how we've decided to go about it.
Yeah, Notre Dame, we would generally have three outputs, an H.264, a ProRes MOV, and then we'd have a ProRes 4-channel master. And on that 4-channel master, you would have remapped audio. You would have four channels of audio. One would be music, one would be nothing but dialogue, one would be nothing but, or like two would be dialogue, one would be sound effects, and one would be nothing but music. And the reason behind that is if you needed to go back and make a change to something quickly, and a lot of that footage was offline, you had the 4-channel master to pull from. It also made, if you were pulling something from a different show and you liked the grade on it already, you could go in and just pluck it like a sound bite, from an interview very, very quickly. It is process intensive, but it made certain aspects easier. And then, yeah, kind of like JP said, anywhere between 10 and 15 on. I like a constant bit rate. I don't like things to be variable. That's just me. I think that's all changing, especially with H.265. If I could right now, I would export an H.265 as long as the platform would take it, just because it's a much more efficient codec when it comes to compression. Not necessarily on decoding it, but you're definitely going to retain more value, more info for the file size. Whereas, you know, you're going to upload it to Twitter, it's going to knock it back down anyway, but still.
So the constant bit rate versus variable bit rate, it's all about what's in your shot, right? So the constant bit rate is really good when there's not a lot of movement. It's interframe versus intraframe differences there. So that's what I was trying to get at with the motion and the game action is high speeds. So if you have a feature that you're doing, you have someone sitting in the chair, you know, doing an interview, it's a talking head, and then you cut to live action content, those are going to need two very different bit rates in order to play back really well. And if it's constant, if it's hitting the same threshold, the same bit rate all the way across, you're going to get a different look. The interview is going to look really good, and the live action might not look quite as good because it doesn't have the additional pixels that it's looking for the bit rate. So it all comes back to depends on what you're doing, and depends on what it is. So if you had all game action in a clip, then constant bit rate should be totally fine there too. So there's variability in different things like that, and all that you're doing. Michael, is there anything else that that you want to have a conversation around? I feel like this was helpful for me to understand your background and how things operate in Major League Soccer, and obviously with the inaugural season that you just got through the crazy time of COVID, which you should be applauded for. Just because I can't imagine not only the new things that came up and how you had to deal with those, but then this on top of all of that. Is there anything else that you want to close with here?
I really appreciate you guys, you know, taking the time to speak, and this conversation was definitely super beneficial. Please believe I'm going to be in both of your inboxes asking you questions about certain things that we haven't sort of gotten to those thresholds yet, like the CatDV. We're definitely looking to sort of push the boundaries and in advance and sort of move forward, but just appreciate the time and appreciate the conversation.
I could talk about this stuff for hours, so anytime.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for hopping on and being willing to have the conversation and, you know, sharing insight to your process and everything that you have going on. So good luck to you as you go forward here, and definitely keep in touch. It's been an enjoyable conversation, so appreciate you.
God bless, guys.
Well, thank you so much for making Creative Sports Podcast part of your day. We'd love to hear your thoughts, feedback, and suggestions, so pop on over to the Sports Creative Community on Slack and connect with us and your fellow creatives. If you're enjoying this podcast, we'd love it if you shared it with a friend or a coworker, and leave us a 5-star rating so other people will be able to find us as well. And don't forget to subscribe so that you're the first person to catch each new episode. Remember, the world needs your voice, so keep creating.